Well, in Popular Sciences magazine's current issue, Ben Hobbins is featured for his invention and marketing of ironclad lures, which remain, I tell you, they're great lures. They're supple, they're lifelike action, but they have incredible strength compared to, similar looking, let's put it that way, lures. And each year, Popular Science, which has a circulation of more than 7 million readers, by the way, worldwide, selects 10 inventions that they judge that best represent the spirit of homegrown ingenuity and solve real-world problems in a practical and innovative way. And I tell you what, those lures and Ben and Tim Oswald, too, has a big role in this. These lures are intended to make life easier for anglers and solve a serious environmental issue at the same time. Did you know there was an environmental issue connected with fishing lures? Well, we'll learn all about that. We'll learn about starting a business and getting a business going, too. And I hope we'll learn a little bit about the science of plastics, too, as we visit with our two guests. Ben Hobbins, Wisconsin inventor and CEO of Ironclads. Soft plastic fishing baits. He's the founder of the Lake Delton Fisheries Restoration Project, sits on the American Sports Fishing Association's Fish America Foundation Conservation Committee. Ben, welcome. Nice to have you. We've talked, about a year ago now or a little more?
A little bit more than that, I think. It was 2 years ago at the World Muskie Classic up at Boulder.
Oh, the World Muskie. Yes, that's right, World Muskie Championship. Yep. So, well, great to have you back.
Thank you.
And Tim Oswald, great to have you with us, too. He is the KK and Cindy Wang Professor and Co-Director of the Polymer Engineering Center at the UW-Madison's Department of Engineering. Tim, great to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me here.
I really appreciate having you both here. How did this whole business get started?
Well, I'll probably be responsible for this response, I guess. grew up in the Madison area here on the chain of lakes and an avid outdoorsman, fisherman as well. Winter was coming and starting to look towards its first freeze, and I was looking forward to the thought of going out ice fishing. But then I started to think about, but my hands are going to freeze because I have to keep re-rigging. And then I was thinking of the fish fries, that we all enjoyed, and thinking, now I need to solve this problem of re-rigging these soft plastic tippers that we use. And that's when the project was born in my mind. I sat there with my mom having a coffee, of all things. Sounds corny, mm-hmm. but it is a little bit. And I said, well, I think I solved it. And that's how the project was born. And there's a lot of steps along the way. And
yeah, we'll talk about some of those. Tim Oswald, how did you get started in that, or how did you get involved?
Well, first, a couple of students from the School of Business came to me and they said, there's this crazy guy in town who invented these fishing lures, he's trying to start a business. And so the business school was involved with it. And so they showed me a drawing, or they tried to explain to me. And I said, these fishing lures end up in the bottom of a lake and they rip, etc. And so that's how they then started the connection. They connected me then with Ben, and we then had our first meeting a couple of years ago.
So what is it about these lures that you provided some science behind to help Ben along with this project, I assume?
Yes. Actually, what really called my attention was these lures, the existing lures, are made out of plasticized PVC. Plasticized just means that they're soft, and the polymer is softened with these chemicals, typically phthalates. In this case here, about half of the weight are phthalates, which is really nasty stuff. I mean, we hear it in the news here and there. They're not good materials. And most of these fishing lures with the 50% weight of phthalates end up in the bottom of lakes and rivers. And so I saw here an opportunity. I've been researching a lot on PVC, on vinyls, on plasticized vinyls, and this presented a right down-to-earth opportunity to maybe create an impact. And that's what triggered my interest. And then the other one also, of course, was the kind of a very clever idea on how to solve the problem. And it had to be realized from the drawings and an idea to actually a finished product. And so that's why Ben came to me.
Yeah, yeah. And as Tim explains, the Weinert consultants that were on board this project here in Madison identified a soft plastic lure waste of 25 million pounds annually. And,
wow.
You know, Larry and all of us here sitting at the table, these things have been around for 5-6 decades and have been literally dropping at high rate. Everything in a store that's up on the wall that's a soft plastic lure is essentially ripped or torn off and lost at the lake bottom. And they're sitting, there's billions of pounds. If you multiply 25 million pounds times 60 years, you figure it's a serious matter. So we were fortunate, I guess I was fortunate to have it, what we people are calling a very innovative idea, and to develop it with a professor in the Palmyra Engineering Center that really has a philosophy centered around sustainable plastics and sustainability in general, and that tends to be the growing trend now. So I think we hit it just right. I'm obviously very thrilled with the award from Popular Science.
Oh, I'm sure you would be. I haven't given the phone number for people to join in if they have questions, so let me do that. Questions or comments as we visit with Ben Hobbins and Professor Tim Oswald of the UW, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And there's a number of ways that you could call and ask questions, a number of things to ask questions about. One thing, you know, fishermen can call in and ask some questions about how the lures work and why they work. Business people who are maybe thinking about getting in a business, there's some question opportunities as well for you. And then this whole business of the plastics industry, I think, is a really interesting area. So we've got like three different things going here. Maybe that's too many. I don't know. But zero in on one that you want to ask about, or maybe two, and give us a call again at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. So you've been able to get the sort of the nasty stuff out of these lures then?
No, as of now, the material is still there, but at least this solution is they will stay outside.
With the lure.
They will not be dropped in the bottom of the lake because they're how resistant they are. But now that these lures will not end up in the bottom of the lake, maybe the next step actually will be finding materials that behave similarly but that are more expensive. Of course, the reason why people use plasticized vinyls or plastisols for these is because it's such a cheap material. And if it ends in the bottom of the lake, they wouldn't want to invest in silicone rubbers or materials that are of higher quality and that are benign but are more expensive. And now with this solution, one would be able to use higher grade materials.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, there's... And Tim is talking about biodegradable materials, plastics that biodegrade over time. You know, there's two sides to every coin. Mm-hmm. And what our invention did immediately, and this is what Popular Science loved about it, was that it immediately stopped the drop of the plastics. And if you take 25 or 12,500 tons and divide it by 300 or 400 less drop plastics, mm-hmm. you get about 40 tons.
Yeah.
And if you spread that 40 tons instead of the 12,500 tons, it's really nothing. But if we're looking at it now, a biodegradable based material, it will be more expensive. When you have biodegradables, you have moisture concerns, yeah. and you have storage concerns with moisture, market acceptance. If you have, you know, you've got two sides of that coin. Okay, a lot of anglers right now would probably not want something that might break down in their tackle box and gunk it up.
Sure.
But at the same time, if the packaging is correct that goes with it to conserve it, it would. But usually when you have a higher quality biodegradable, you need more packaging, which means it's offset with more packaging. So you get into this circle, but then you can
vicious circle.
It becomes kind of a tough deal here. I think there's those two market niches that are definitely there and that need to be addressed. People that would be willing to possibly go with more packaging. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely the market where anglers want something that stays on the hook.
Oh, yeah, definitely that. Ken in Oshkosh has a question for you. Let's go to Ken. Hi, Ken. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering, you know, in plastic and in, like, jig heads or whatever, you know, they have all different colors, speckles, you know, could be yellow, green, black, you know, chartreuse. I always thought fish were colorblind.
They react to different shades of gray, I think, is what fish are looking at. And if you've ever looked at black and white photography, you'll notice, you know, reds and yellows and these other colors have these kind of tendencies to give a different shade of gray. And from there, this is what we're looking at for those different colors that you're talking about. And,
mm-hmm. In other words, you're just looking at a flash point, you know, something that... It kind of makes you know, a flash in the water.
Well, it could be a flash in the water, or it could be a not really a flash so much with rubber worms or with those plastic worms, but the movement,
vibration,
both vibration and then movement, and then you've got the various shades,
mm-hmm.
The various hues what attracts the fish.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. And they'll mimic the shade. Sometimes they'll mimic the shades of, you know, earthworms or night crawlers, and sometimes they're totally
exactly.
different.
Exactly. Yeah, anything that gives a little flash or that mm-hmm. Gives a vibration also for the lateral lines on the fish. Yep.
Thank you, Ken, for calling. And, Deed, I hope you'll stay with us. We'll get to you in just a second. Our guest, Ben Hobbins, and Tim Oswald, and our other guest, as we talk with them about ironclad fishing lures. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Glad you're along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here as we visit with two guests today. Ben Hobbins, Wisconsin inventor, CEO of Ironclads. It's a line of revolutionary soft plastic fishing baits. And he's the founder of the Lake Delton Fisheries Restoration Project, sits on the American Sports Fishing Association's Fish America Foundation Conservation Committee, one of our guests. He worked with Professor Tim Oswald, who is our other guest, KK and Cindy Wang, professor and co-director of the Polymer Engineering Center at the UW-Madison's College of Engineering. I think I said Department of Engineering earlier, and I meant College of Engineering. Mechanical Engineering Department. My wife, Renee, works in the College of Engineering and would be giving me lots of grief.
She's going to get you later.
for not saying that correctly. Oh, man. We're visiting about these lures, the fantastic lures, and also about business and also about plastic. So I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. And callers online who've been waiting a while, so let's go to the phones here. Deed in Wisconsin Rapids, we'll go to you now. Thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hey, no problem. Great guest today. I've got a little information on the colors that fish see as far as the largemouth bass. I think if you look into the University of Indiana, did a lot of research on largemouth back in the early 80s. And they found that the largemouth has the same cones as humans do, the same color receptors. So if you do the math on that, that'll help you decide what color to use.
Yep.
They seem to see the same as we do. My major question is being able to use these ironclad baits as far as plastic worms go. The when you Texas rig a plastic worm, you need a certain amount of toughness so that the worm head doesn't slip over the knot, but you still need it soft enough so that the tip of the sharpened hook and barb get through the worm on a hook set and into the fish.
Yeah.
And that's
and that's exactly right. And if you haven't seen these lures, Deed, well, I'll let Ben talk about that because they
sure.
You so, can't tell the difference.
Yeah, the lures that are out there are that we the lure lines that we've got out are six different lines. There's the worms and the stick baits. There's the tube baits. There's a craw shrimp tail, and then there's a jerk shad. And those are, you know, if you're an angler, you know, those are pretty much the your number one selections per se as a shape in a soft plastic lure. The difference with our lures is that there is skin graft technology, principles of skin graft technology that are inside the lure in kind of a tubular fashion that reinforces the plastic lure. It gives it that strength. So when you actually do hook up, not every type of Texas rig or Carolina rig hook is made for these lures. You need to have a straight shank, a Gamagatsu type straight shank. Texas or Carolina rig hook works really well. And once you hook on into that Trick series worm of the Ironclad series, you get something that you'll probably catch 30 or 40 fish on in the boat, really caught fish. I think our records are over the 40s for the Trick series worm. Oh. And we're over 200 on the wacky style rigging on a stick bait, which is unheard of.
Wow, I guess so. How about floatability? What would you say the drop rate with like a true turn hook?
Yeah.
A 2-aught?
Yeah, but on a 2-aught, well, it depends on the lure here. These lures are designed actually for fishermen, so they're not designed, as you know, some of our competitors out there design their, like a stick bait to kind of dive down fast, and the faster they dive, the faster they're in the weeds, too, and the faster you rip them off, in a way. You know, they're tough to fish. If there's a fast drop rate, they're tough to fish in all conditions. So our lures are designed to narrowly float without a hook in them. As soon as you put a hook in them, you get a real nice, easy drop rate, which means if you're river fishing or dock fishing, you get a very long, slow drop presentation. And the technology, the tubular graft material inside, it gives almost a door stopper effect. If you're doing a wacky style, you get almost a door stopper vibration when you flick your rod tip, and it just gets a real nice, easy, slow drop, and you'll be amazed. And for skipping and stuff like that, you can just let her rip with these, and they don't rip and tear off because of that skin graft material that's inside.
Hmm.
If you make an electric blue color, you sold me big time.
We have them. Yeah, they're out there. There's electric blue, silver flake. Yep, you're all set.
I fished all the tours, including the Bassmaster, the Red Man tours, all over the United States, and those are the main important things that I look for in a worm, somewhat neutral buoyant, and something that will hold up to a lot of fish will definitely loosen up maybe an extra 50 pounds of plastics I carry to each tournament.
Yeah.
Any good bass fisherman will know that if you have the right color, the right pattern, sometimes you can go through, it's not unusual to go through 100 worms in a 8-hour
tournament.
Period.
Yeah, in a day. You know, well, you're right, and we've got about 15 pro staff all over the U.S., and their comments before they came on board as pro staffers were exactly the ones you mentioned. And what they find is that they don't have downtime, you know, for all anglers in general. If you get in a fish, you don't want to be spending your time looking for digging around for bags and re-rigging. You just want to stay on them and try to catch as many as you can, because that's what makes fishing fun. And if you're in a tournament situation, obviously that means you might win a tournament if you're able to get another fish or two out of that group before they spook and disperse, you know. And you know how it is, depending
well,
on
bet.
Your
we look at a lure as a tournament as cast per hour.
Yeah.
And fish per hour, and in a tournament we're against the fish, not against each other, and that is a real major thing. Well, bless you, sir. You really helped me out a lot.
Well, these are made from an angler for anglers, so it's not necessarily an industry play here. This is something that was meant to solve a problem for us guys that love to fish, and it also hits that environmental side, that conservation note that's so important on sustainability. And that's why, you know, we teamed up with Dr. Oswald here to help develop some really are perfect first prototypes that won so many awards.
I guess so. Are you going to the ASA show this year?
Yeah, down in Orlando, yes.
Great. Hopefully we'll see you on there.
Yeah, I look forward to meeting you. We'll have products and a new product showcase, too.
Thanks, Dean. And, of course, the products now, in terms of just for before we get to Jim and Madison here, you can get them pretty much anywhere?
Yeah. Gander Mountain's got them. We're speaking from the Madison area here, but most of the local area stores have them. If they don't have them, if they don't know about them, ask them to look into Ironclad Lures, and you can find those by just simply doing a Google search under Ironclad. You'll get our website right off the bat, but we do have a website, ironcladlures.com, that you can go to and
order off the website.
There's actually an e-commerce site that's due to be up in about a week, I'm told. That's being developed by another university student group, and so we try to keep the university involved in all of our development, because it just kind of adds that networking effect and just a lot of enthusiasm.
Thanks again, Deed, for calling. Appreciate it. Jim and Madison will turn to you next. Jim, hello.
Hello there. Thanks for having my call.
Sure.
This is a fantastic topic. And I just I have a two-part question. The first being, with the people who initially developed these nasty substances for the worms, wouldn't they have suspected, being that they made those plastics for the worms, or is it just something they just didn't think about? And then the second part of my question is, you talked about the paradox of how to outweigh the environmentally safe product with the wrapping. And I'd like to just go a step further with that and pose a question. You're talking about doing this all for the sake of the environment. And for the sake of fishermen who love to fish and all that and love the environment, if you really think about it deeper, wouldn't the best thing for the environment be to not do this at all, given the problems with logistics, the substances it takes to produce these marketable objects, and then the fact that it's even adding, yes, it is less effect on the environment, but it is just another thing that's going to lay in the bottom of the rivers.
All right.
I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling. I'm going to turn to Tim Oswald, Professor Oswald, comments from you first.
Yeah, actually, it's an excellent question. Yeah, that's a question that I ask myself often is how can these nasty substances be out there? And it's a question that I pose ethically to myself as I teach my students how to make things out of plastics. And so it's something that I've thought at great length. Yeah, these plasticizers have been around for 60, 70 years in their use. I mean, you have them in your shower curtains. It's the new car smell in your car. And the people using them, sure, I think engineers and people who manufacture these products know about it. And the question is, are they being proactive in trying to find solutions where they're no longer present? And so to the second part, is there are solutions out there. For example, of course, Ben talked about the biodegradable ones that would bring packaging in, but there are other ones that are not biodegradable that could be manufactured, of course, at a higher cost with materials that don't have these plasticizers, such as silicone rubbers, which are silica-based. I mean, these are even less dependent on petroleum, for example. Materials that work really well have the same properties as these soft lures, but at a higher cost. It wouldn't have even need packaging for that much, because there's now no plasticizer to seep out from them. That's one thing is these lures, of course, they have to be packaged as they are now, because they contain the plasticizers that will leach out. So there are solutions. I don't think doing it completely is not a solution. I mean, it won't work. Mm-hmm. That's how people do that. I mean, that's a hobby. And so I think it's just being proactive, trying to find a solution that is good for the environment and of course, in people's pocketbooks.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the other part of the question had to do with... packaging, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Any comments on that? Or Tim, too?
I'll hit it just a little bit in regard to this particular market itself. And about, I think the caller had a question about the industry knowing about this and where they
went.
Oh,
that's right, yeah.
Yeah, from my experience of being in an industry player for the short few years I have been, I would say that because most of these lures actually, when they rip and tear and come off, they actually sink. Mm-hmm. And I think it didn't occur to, I haven't met anybody that it occurred to them just what was taking place and what the effect really was. And I think that that gives credit to Dr. Oswald and to some of his students and also to the Weinert students and some other studies from other universities that have actually uncovered the question of, you know, where are all those plastics going, those soft plastic lures going that you see covering the walls of sporting goods stores. You know, it was just never thought about because it was out of sight, out of mind, I think. And, you know, I think that was the issue there. Now it's coming front and center. The other thing about the packaging is if we're talking biodegradables, there is a need for more packaging. So that offsets that environmental idea that you think mm-hmm. that you're doing good for when you've got those out in the boat and you open your packaging, something blows out and goes in the lake or, you know, inadvertently. And, you know, that's a, you know, so you think you're helping on one side, but you get hit with the other one. You know, there are studies out there, and Tim and I have looked at this recently from the North American Fisheries Management Journal in regard to soft plastic lures and the effect that they have, the negative effect they have on fish that ingest those. And I think Tim read that through. You can probably answer a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, they found fish with some of these lures in their stomachs, and of course, it's like fish are people eat them. These plasticizers, some of them are, of course, phthalates, which are emulate estrogen, and it, I mean, it does. It goes on and on. I mean, even if what is in them, if I suggest anybody who is there, I mean, people put their worms, for example, natural worms, in styrofoam cups. If you do the same with a fishing lure, it will eat the soft plastic fishing lure. It will eat the styrofoam away. So that's the effect of these phthalates, the plasticizing action, making things soft. So, I mean, these chemicals, of course, are it's something that you wouldn't want in the stomach of the fish, and they end up being in the stomach, and they swell up. So there's all kinds of problems.
Intestinal blockage that they're not able to consume the quantity of food that they need to gain the nutrients they need to live, and so the fish become stunted, according to the North American Fisheries Management Journal article from April.
And so, but with your lures, they're not going to be breaking these. Talk about the strength of these particular lures. It's amazing.
Well, Tim put a bunch of guys on for that test, and he can explain that.
Yeah, I mean, they've increased, obviously, the original lures, when you put the hook through, it doesn't take much force to break them.
Even if you
stretch them out, they're quite resilient. They will stretch out very rubbery and will break with only a couple of pounds or so. These, with a reinforcement inside, with a composite reinforcement, and can resist, on the size, even the small ones can resist up to 100 pounds, which is now a huge force. I mean, they could be made even stronger if we wanted to use different braiding inside of the fishing lure. So the strength has been increased and can be managed higher or lower, but still, you still... From the outset, you don't notice a difference in the fishing lure. It's still rubbery. It looks the same. The only thing is now it won't stretch, and, of course, it won't rip.
Yeah, and it's soft, and it has that door stopper action, which gives that vibration that you don't... A normal soft lure is mush when you jig that, and, you know, most fishermen know that. You think, oh, there's a lot of action. Well, there's really not when you have... These lures that you can flick your rod tip and it sends out vibration. You'll see just how fast these fish come in tinted water, colored water or just regular water, and you flick your rod tip and that vibration goes. Everyone knows, has heard the door stopper in the bathroom when you quick grab that thing so it's not so loud. This does that underwater. It's like a fish call that agitates the fish to come and hit that thing.
Well, let's talk. You have throughout the show today, you've talked about working with the university, and I think there's some lessons in terms of getting a business started. Talk a bit about that.
Sure. Earlier in the show we discussed how I came up with the idea. Well, for any project, your product is the sum of its parts, and there's various parts to this project. There's various parts that made this project successful, and I want to be sure to mention all those. For any inventor or for anyone that wants to start a business, you look at your idea and you see how you can make it successful, and that's your first question, and try to identify how, which partners could help you. Here in Madison area and here in the state of Wisconsin, we have a wonderful network, the Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Network, the Wisconsin Innovation Service Center, who has literature over at the engineering library here in Madison. We've got the University of Wisconsin-Madison Business School with the Weinert Center that are specialists in enterprise development and really going after the bacon, so to speak. And you've got engineering, the component right next door that has all the expertise to do the actual prototype development almost in any type of application you could imagine in its various departments. So, I would urge anyone that's got an idea that they think is good or worth looking at is start your research at the engineering library, which is a United States Patent and Trademark Office library in Madison at the Wendt Library. Go in there, work with the specialists there who are there to help for research, and start doing your research. And then at the same time, if you're successful in identifying your idea as being unique, start looking at partnering with those partners that are right here in the area. And be proactive about it. If you've got something good, don't develop any illusions that it's good. Make sure it's based on solid research. And if you've got something that's solid, you can go to somebody like Dr. Oswald here and just show them what it is and show them your research and see if you can't get some co-development agreement going and take it from there.
Yeah, and from your end, Professor Oswald. Working with people like Ben?
Yeah, I mean, Ben, of course, is one side of the spectrum of people we work with, which is really an individual with an idea. I mean, then we work with industry, companies that come to solve problems at our research labs. We write our own proposals, of course, in the area, in more in-depth research that is funded by those companies or by the federal government or by the state government. So that's all part of the whole bigger picture of what we do in research in the College of Engineering, is working all the way from individuals to applied science to more fundamental science. And this is just one, which would be applied science, working with really one person with one idea and carrying it through using sound science and engineering.
The thing to look at here, too, is to realize that the engine of our economy are small businesses, and usually it's based around ideas. And that's where I encourage people to really, because the general development in our economy is based from that base, actually, is that if you've got an idea, make sure that you go after it. Don't just sit there and look into these partners. Look into Dr. Oswald if you're in plastics. Look into the other departments of UW Engineering. Look into the business school. Look at the Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Network. Get a new product assessment done by WISC. You know, there's just people that are out there that are part of our system designed to help create business and create jobs, and don't hesitate to really take the ball and run with it.
And on that note, positive note, I want to thank you both for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Ben Hobbins, Wisconsin inventor, CEO of Ironclads, the soft plastic fishing baits that recently won, was one of 10 inventions selected to by Popular Science magazine that best represent the spirit of homegrown ingenuity and real-world problem-solving. Professor Tim Oswald helped and was very instrumental in developing those lures. And thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.